This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Well, it's tax day, so in our next hour, we will have a brief conversation with Grover Norquist. Hang on to your hat. Just a quick tip, our website, we have been getting so much demand, so much heavy usage at TomHartman.com that we are moving our site to a little more robust server at the moment, and the site has been down for several hours. And for those folks who want to drop into our live chat room, if you go to tomhartman.org, T-H-O-M and Hartman with two N's, .org, you will find a link to our live chat room, so you can get over there. So let me just, you know, make that announcement right up at the top. So, have Republicans hijacked justice? What crimes have the Bush administration committed? And this is the issue. This is so timely because I've been talking about this for a couple of weeks now in a big way, saying, and will the Democrats hold them accountable after the elections, after the inauguration? And those of you who listen regularly to the program know that for a long, long time, I have been saying we need to be contacting our Democratic politicians and asking them bluntly, after the election, will you do what, for example, Bill Clinton did when he came in and basically just walk away from all of the investigations and possible investigations into Iran-Contra and the crimes of the Reagan and Bush administrations that preceded him? Or what the Bush senior administration did, walking away again from the investigations of Iran-Contra and other crimes involved in the Reagan administration. Or what the Ford administration did, walking away from the crimes of the Nixon administration. And it's not like there's not precedent for this. Even Carter really didn't want to go after the Ford administration for anything that might have happened there with Cheney and Rumsfeld as the Secretary of Defense. Cheney was the Secretary of Defense. He was Chief of Staff. Cheney was Secretary of Defense. And it's like, at what point do you say to the incoming administration, at what point do they say, no, you know, we're not going to let it have a pass anymore? This terrible precedent that was established by Gerry Ford pardoning not just, you know, all of Richard Nixon's cronies. In fact, actually, he didn't even pardon some of the low-level guys. Yeah, you know, G. Gordon Liddy, a lot of these guys, they went to jail. But he did pardon Richard Nixon. The pardon is the one kingly right that was preserved in the Constitution from the days of kings, and there was a huge debate over it. A huge debate over it at the Constitutional Convention. And I think that right to pardon has been abused, and I think it has been used. Even not even the right to pardon, but just the right to ignore is the larger one that I've been talking about, is that, you know, administrations just say, that was the past. We're looking toward the future. Well, that's fine. I think that in a government with a couple hundred thousand employees, maybe millions of employees and lots of departments and agencies and offices and things, you can do both. We can chew gum and walk at the same time. So finally, somebody asked this question of Barack Obama. To the best of my knowledge, the question has not been asked of Hillary Clinton. Who knows? Maybe it'll come up in the debates tomorrow. That would be interesting. But over at Philly.com, the Attitude blog, the blogger there has asked this question. What would you do? What would you do, Barack Obama, with regard to the crimes of the Bush administration? This is Will Bunch asking this question over at Philly.com. And this is so cool. This is Barack Obama's answer. He said, what I would want to do is have my Justice Department, How refreshing is it? You know, Alberto Gonzalez can't even get a job right now because everybody realizes how corrupted he was and how incompetent he was. Barack Obama says, what I would want to do is have my Justice Department and my Attorney General immediately review the information that's already there and to find out, are there inquiries that need to be pursued? He goes on to say, if crimes have been committed, they should be investigated. You're also right that I would not want my first term consumed by what was perceived on the part of Republicans as a partisan witch hunt, because I think we've got too many problems we've got to solve. So this is an area where I would want to exercise judgment. I would want to find out directly from my Attorney General, are there possibilities of genuine crimes as opposed to really bad policies? This is, we're quoting Barack Obama here in his conversation with Will Bunch, who blogs his attitude blog over at Philly.com. And Obama goes on to say, and I think it's important. One of the things we've got to figure out in our political culture generally is distinguishing between really dumb policies and policies that rise to the level of criminal activity. He says, if I found out that there were high officials who knowingly, consciously broke existing laws, engaged in cover-ups of those crimes with knowledge forefront, then I think a basic principle of our Constitution, now keep in mind Barack Obama was a professor of constitutional law, teacher of constitutional law, then I think a basic principle of our Constitution is nobody above the law. And I think that's roughly how I would look at it. So, you know, I want to sing hallelujah to that. Now it, what's fascinating is after Will Bunch posted this over at Philly.com, it's a blog, you know, the Attitude blog, and of course people can comment on the blog. And so you're immediately, the right-wingers come in hysterical. And this is how it will play out, by the way. You know, the genius blogging over there, commenting on Attitude's blog, he says, on Will Bunch's blog, he says, Bunch, do you think there was waterboarding under Clinton, JFK, or Carter? Fool. Liberals, waterboarding. Oh, no. But chopping off people's head, using gas, burning them alive, burning them with irons, hanging them from the ceiling, cutting off their hands, that's okay. Those poor Al-Qaeda terrorists are just misunderstood. They probably had bad parents. Hate America first. What a group, great group of liberals. That's the right wing's response to let's see if crimes were committed. Here's another one from another. Those are the first two posts. Here's the third post. When does defending the Constitution or calling for crimes to be punished become hate America first? I believe that defending the Constitution and fair but strict treatment of criminals is a main strand of love America. Well, good on you, Archimedes. But then a poll comes in with a little cynical note. Bush will pardon all his buddies, including himself. See, I think that that's true, but that doesn't mean that you can't do investigations. You can't have prosecutions. You can't bring things to light. Bush has already said he's going to try and reinvent history. They're raising $500 million, $500 million, to have resident scholars in the Bush Library reinventing history. Ian Mack, another right-winger, posting on the Attitude blog, he says, I feel so much better knowing that a President Obama is going to spend his time and energy going after his fellow Americans who've been protecting us from the Islamic terrorists who are intent on killing Americans. And Hulk, another right-winger, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Let's waste time and taxpayer dollars looking for potential crimes of the previous administration. And what would that solve exactly? Well, I'll tell you what it would solve. It would solve things like the future possibility or prospect of a president, again, lying us into a war. It would solve the future possibility of an entire party involving themselves in caging, in stealing millions of votes. It would prevent a future president or administration from engaging in summary executions and assassinations. It would prevent a future administration from violations of the Presidential Records Act. We now know that there's over 5 million emails that were required by law to be kept, that this administration not only lost and then vanished, but then they actually took the computers out and had them destroyed. They crushed the hard drives. So it would be impossible for somebody from the FBI forensic hard drive guy, whatever, to find the information. You tell me that's not a crime? Extraordinary renditions and torture. We have 108 people that we know of who have been murdered while under, quote, harsh interrogation. and John Yoo is still walking around loose in Berkeley? Give me a break. The violation, this is the willful violations of habeas corpus, and then not only that, coming along and passing a law to repeal habeas corpus, when it's in the Constitution that it can only be suspended during time of rebellion or invasion? Torture at home? These are against war crime laws in the United States, against American laws, not to mention international laws. What about Sarah Taylor and Rove and their violations of the Hatch Act? I mean, there's no end to the crimes of this administration. If Barack Obama is going to look into them, if he's going to prosecute them, I salute him.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's so interesting. This is the first discussion that I've seen in any media of a national candidate, of a national presidential candidate, and now there basically are only two. But, I mean, even before, well, actually, Dennis Kucinich was talking about looking into the crimes of this administration. But this is the first time that it has really broken into the mainstream discussion, and but not necessarily in the corporate media. It's going to be interesting to see how this comes out. Karl Rove last night talking about what he wants to talk about. Barack Obama, of course, the Republicans all want to beat up on Barack Obama.
You know, it was almost Marxian in this. They cling to their religion. I mean, it's sort of like it's the opiate of the masses.
Barack Obama as a Marxist. That was Karl Rove last night on Hannity and Combs. Here's Joe Lieberman yesterday.
Senator Lieberman, you know Barack Obama. Is he a Marxist, as Bill Kristol says might be the case in today's New York Times? Is he an elitist like your colleague Hillary Clinton says he is?
Well, you know, I must say that's a good question.
It's a good question?
For a little more than 3 years since he came into the Senate. And
that's a good question?
He's very smart and he's a good guy. I will tell you that during this campaign I've learned some things about him. About the kind of environment from which he came ideologically.
He lived in Indonesia?
I'd hesitate to say he's a Marxist, but...
I've learned something about the environment that he came from. What do you mean being raised by a single mother in small town Kansas? Somehow I think not. Anyhow, I'd love to hear Hillary Clinton say the same thing. That here it is, what I would... quoting Barack Obama over at the Philly.com, the Attitudes blog over at Philly.com, what I would want to do is have my Justice Department and my Attorney General immediately review the information that's already there and to find out if there are inquiries that need to be pursued. He makes it clear he doesn't want to turn it into a witch hunt. He doesn't think it should be political. But, hey, if crimes were committed, well, as he says, if I found out that there were high officials who knowingly, consciously broke existing laws, engaged in cover-ups of those crimes with knowledge of forefront, then I think a basic principle of our Constitution is nobody's above the law, and that's roughly how I would look at it. And the comments then on Obama's comments, you know, people can comment on Attitude's blog, Will Bunch's blog. Do you remember what happened on 9/11? Give me a break. I wish Democrats like Obama did. First thing you lefties dudes need to do is get the difference between a mistake and a lie. It's a simple distinction. That takes care of most of the problems. Yes, all Bush did was make mistakes. Today we have thousands of these aging baby boomers still clinging to that nutso left-wing junk. The heroes who stood up for America after 9/11 are somehow cast as villains. I say again, how silly. And then there's some rational responses. I wonder what shock the founding fathers would be in if they read some of the comments on this blog. Constitution, civil liberties, who cares? Just give us security and safety? This Patrick Henry's speech before the colonial Virginia legislature, which concluded with his famous phrase, give me liberty or give me death, ring hollow today? Well, yeah, it does. All these guys are, they're not saying give me liberty or give me death. They're saying, you know, give us torture, give us, you know, extraordinary renditions, give us snooping into our emails, give us snooping into our websites, give us listening in on our phone calls, give us spying on us from the sky, give us RID, FRID chips in our driver's licenses so that we can be constantly monitored by our guy. Give us that so that we, maybe won't have a terrorist attack. Please. We don't want to die. We don't care about liberty. That's the fundamental conservative talking point right now. Here's another one from Will Bunch's, the comments on his blog. What a useless question. What a useless answer. So very typical and expected to get the liberals excited and drooling all over themselves. If President Obama is a joke to start with. Obama is already showing signs of a big loser. Wait till everyone realizes he's a black militant with ties to a Middle Eastern terrorist. The email buzz is going again. I'm getting these things, you know. Oh, you know, the he's an anti-Semite stuff. Oh, he's a, or he has friends who are, he's a terrorist stuff. There's one going around that he knew one of the 9/11 hijackers. I mean, give me a break. Here's another one over the, another one of these comments. Obama throws some red meat to the moon bats with a hollow promise to prosecute the Bush administration. Is it hollow? Another one says, this middle name Hussein is his log on over at the Philly.com blog. This is a bone Barack Obama is throwing to the large kook fringe of the Democrat Party. They all still suffer BDS, Bush Derangement Syndrome, and Barack is acting as their pusher, stringing them along with fixes of Bush hate until the election. No, it's that we love the Constitution. We love this country, and we love the idea of a nation living under the rule of law and being, as John Kennedy said in his inaugural, and as Ronald Reagan said, quoting Kennedy, although he didn't give him credit for it, Kennedy was actually quoting John Winthrop, 1640, we are that city on a hill. We are the beacon to the world. We would like to be that again. We would like, once again, to be the nation that other nations want to be like. Why is it that more countries want to be like Sweden than like us? Another Zai Zha. It's a shame. The left thinks Bush, not the terrorists, is the true enemy. It's tragic. 27 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270. Your calls up next.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
The dream is fading now. I'm staring at the door. I know it's over cause my feet have hit the cold floor. Check my reflection, I ain't feeling what I see. It's no mystery. Whatever happened to a passion I could live for? What became of the flame that made me feel more? And when did I forget that I was made to love you? I was made to find you.
I was made to for you. So-called policy memo from July 2002 says intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy of removing Saddam through military action. Is this an accurate reflection of what happened? Could both of you respond?
Well, I read kind of the characterizations of the memo, particularly when they dropped it out in the middle of his race.
It's the Downing Street memo.
I'm not sure who they dropped it out either, but I'm not suggesting that you all dropped it out there. somebody said, well, you know, we had made up our mind to go to use military force to deal with Saddam. There's nothing farther from the truth. My conversations with the prime minister was, how can we do this peacefully?
Yeah. Well, and of course, Resolution 1441 of the UN put the inspectors in, and Hans Blix was in there, and he was looking around. And,
you know, in the Middle Ages, when people were convinced there were witches, and then they looked for them, they certainly found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence. And I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
But he went on to say he did not have that. And yet Bush, here, now, so the UN puts in Hans Blix and the weapons inspectors. They're blowing up the rockets that were like, had 5 miles more range than they were legally allowed to have. The few weapons that they were able to find. They're finding nothing. They have absolutely unlimited access to the country. They're running all over the place. And Bush pulls them out so he can start his war. And then he goes on national television and he says this.
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in. And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
Right. Saddam Hussein would not allow the weapons inspectors in? No. Sorry, George. You were the guy who pulled them out. You were the guy who pulled them out. I mean, it's mind-boggling. And he's the one, you know.
Osama bin Laden doesn't get to decide.
Yes, he did.
The American people decide.
Nope.
I decided. The right action was in Iraq.
Yeah, and that's exactly what Osama bin Laden wanted. He was very clear he wanted us to essentially bleed to death in a war in the Middle East.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Mm-hmm. And then as he's announcing to the world that he's going to invade Iraq because he has pulled out the inspectors, and he says, bombing is going to start in a couple hours, and the whole world is watching and expecting him to say something like, all you soldiers in Iraq, why don't you just give up your weapons? Because we just assume, we don't want to put our young men and women in harm's way. And we are, we've had an overwhelming military force. So just lay down your weapons and there won't be much bloodshed and everything will be fine. And instead, he says this.
Your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
And the whole world is going, what? 866-303-2270. Jeff in Orange County, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for reading some of those blogs and putting out what Barack said. I find it absolutely, I'll have to laugh, otherwise I'll cry, at all of these right-wingers who were so ready to ride the wave of an era of accountability when they came in, and they wanted to hold everybody accountable for, personal affairs and so on along this line. But when war crimes have been committed, we don't want to look here anymore. I think it's really humorous that in those two elections, I think a big portion of why George Bush received so much of a push was because he was riding on this era of accountability. But then I find in 2004, no one from the Democratic side brought it up in any way, shape, or form. Yeah. And I think that in both of these elections in 2004, if had Kerry and I tried to get through to his party as much as possible to say, hang them high. I am going to investigate everything. I don't care where the path leads me, how high it leads me. But when we find crimes have been committed, there will be no pardons. There will be no commutations of sentences. People will be held accountable exactly as they said they wanted to be. Yeah. These are landslide winning policies to hold.
Absolutely.
For the left wing.
And these were the Bush positions. These were the Republican positions in 2000. You're absolutely right. They went after Bill Clinton on everything they could find and said, we've got to hold him accountable for firing travel agents in the White House. Didn't you know? There may be something political about that. And what was Hillary doing in the Rose Law Office back 30 years ago? And what about 35 years ago when Bill Clinton put $30,000 into a land deal and lost it all? Maybe there's something criminal about that, that Whitewater thing. And on and on. Oh, it's accountability. It's all about accountability. And he's doing what in the West Wing with Monica Lewinsky? Holy cow, we can't have that. We've got to hold him accountable. And then a Democrat says, maybe we should hold the Republicans accountable for actual crimes. And the right wing goes hysterical. Gary in Seattle. Hey, Gary.
Oh, hi, Tom. Yeah, I think that the restoration of the integrity of the justice system is absolutely essential. I mean, if we don't know that the justice system is being used to actually enforce justice instead of being used as a political bludgeon against your enemies. I mean, what kind of a country is this? That's what they used to do in various fascistic regimes that we don't like to talk about,
Yeah, in the Soviet Union. I mean, that's what it used to be. And there's that famous, probably apocryphal story. The first time I went to Russia, after the fall of Russia, when I was in Kaliningrad, in fact, it was during the first election. It was when Yeltsin was running for the first election in 1,000 years in Russia. Several Russians, I was hanging out with a bunch of Russians, I'd heard the story before. Everybody in Russia knows this story. Whether it happened or not, who knows? But everybody in Russia knows this story of how, Khrushchev had been a good, loyal member of the Politburo under Stalin, as Stalin was literally executing his political opposition and murdering people for standing up to him. And now Khrushchev is the head of the USSR. And he gets up, and in one of his opening speeches after Stalin died, Khrushchev is talking about what a bad guy Stalin was. They dehabilitated Stalin. And as he's giving the speech, somebody in the back of the room, so, you know, he's giving the speech to the Politburo, and somebody in the back says, "Well, why were you sitting, you know, where were you when, or what was the, what was the, yeah, where were you when Stalin was committing these crimes? Why didn't you speak up?" And the room goes silent. Khrushchev looks around and says, "Who said that?" Nobody says a thing. Khrushchev scowls and looks around, you know, into the lights and all the people sitting in the Politburo, hundreds of people there. "Who said that?" Nobody replies. He pounds his fist on the table. He's screaming now, "Who said that?" Nobody's even breathing. He leans forward on the podium, smiles, and says, "You're sitting where I was sitting when Mr. Stalin was here, and now you understand why I did not speak up." And that's what's happening right now in the White House press room. I mean, it's been a week since it was released in the news that John Yoo and all these guys were writing these memos saying, "Sure, George, you can violate the Constitution, you can violate U.S. laws on torture, you can violate the Geneva Conventions, you can commit murder." I mean, there some of these people who died under torture and interrogation in the hands of the United States, it has already been ruled murder. You can commit murder, and we'll help you get away with it. And nobody in the White House press corps has yet asked the question of Dana Perino, is anybody in the Bush administration going to be held accountable for these crimes? Are you guys going back and talking to John Yoo about these memos? Joseph in Vermont. Joseph, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. How you doing? Hey, listen, Tom, as a former Vermonter and as a radio talk show host that actually has Bernie on Fridays, which I think is a great thing, we should not forget the influence of those third and fourth party influences. And it's not true that none of the national candidates don't want to hold.
I said none of the Democratic candidates. If you're going where you're going is that Ralph Nader's been talking about this, you're absolutely right. And by the way, let me add, when I was living in Vermont, during the 10 years that I lived in Vermont, among those was the year 2000, and I voted for Ralph Nader in that election.
Right, and once again, when you're talking about Hitler and, Khrushchev and Stalin and so forth, remember that Obama is going to be taking that position also. He's not going to hold these people accountable, and you know it. This is a bone to the so-called left wing of the Democratic Party.
I'm sorry, Joseph, I'm not that skeptical. He is I'm trying really hard not to be an Obama partisan here. But I'm just amazed by the fact that this is the first candidate for president of the United States that hasn't taken PAC money that's a serious contender. Frankly, I think in my lifetime. You know, and I think it's entirely possible that he will keep that word. And I'd love to see it. I'd love to see the thing happen. So, you know, we'll see. Chris in St. Louis, you're also skeptical.
Yes, I'm skeptical because Barack Obama's answer is the same thing that every Democrat has been saying since Nancy Pelosi took over as Speaker of the House. And I don't believe for a moment that
I haven't heard any of them say that the Attorney General on the first day of the new administration should investigate whether actual crimes have been committed by the Bush administration. I have not heard anybody say that. I agree with you that, you know, the let's not impeach line has been basically, well, let's investigate. And I agree that the investigations haven't been anywhere near as aggressive as they could be, in large part because the Bush administration refuses to let people testify. And then when they say, make them testify, the Department of Justice says, no, we won't prosecute.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
But it's business as usual. Oh,
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. And we've been keeping you up to date on our Berlusconi alerts. Yes, good old Silvio. What do you do? He's 71 years old, by the way. Same age as John McCain. What do you do when you own all the radio stations, all the television stations, and most of the newspapers in a country, as Berlusconi does, even though he started out as a small-time crook and entrepreneur, built himself a multi-billion dollar empire? What do you do when you control all the media in the country? You run for prime minister, and it looks like he's won again. Our Berlusconi alert for the day. And in addition to this, this from Reuters. Ballot stuffing took on a new meaning in Italy's parliamentary elections on Sunday when a man ate his ballot paper in protest at the country's politicians. 41-year-old businessman was charged with destroying election materials. They don't use voting machines there. They only vote on paper. He said all Italian politicians and politics are crap, but he was protesting against the system by eating his ballots. Yeah. Jonathan in North Carolina. Hey, Jonathan, what's up? Jonathan, you are on the air. No, Jonathan. Okay. Let's see here. Diane, in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Diane.
Hi. I don't know if anyone's mentioned this, but I found it very confusing that someone, that Barack Obama or anyone, could be called a Marxist and an elitist at the same time. Since a Marxist is someone who's for the working class, and an elitist is someone who's not for the working class.
Right. Well, you know, this is the thing. It's devolved to name calling, and they're throwing everything they can against this guy, the hard right, and any name that they can make stick, they're going to try and make stick. I mean, they've also called him a Muslim, which isn't true, and they've called him a black nationalist, or it just goes on and on and on. All the names that they've called him. The thing that I think is amazing is that he has survived all this stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And the more this happens, the more people flock to him.
Yeah, and yesterday in the corporate media on the cable shows, they were showing pictures that the right has produced of hyper photoshopped Barack Obama in a very kind of looking down his nose pose and talking about his being arrogant, and it just, you know, and Pat Buchanan going off on this, and I could just hear the word uppity. You know, he was just so fighting not to use that word, because I think that really is what it was all about. I thought it was horrible. Diane, thank you for the call. You know, well said. Jonathan in North Carolina, you want to try it again?
Yes, sir. You said something a while ago about the Constitution. You love in the Constitution.
I do.
And your side, you may say that, but the person you vote for shows your real dedication to the Constitution. And you're saying that Obama or Clinton, one of these basically Marxist socialists, and you're counting them to the Constitution, that you'd vote for them to protect the Constitution when their voting record is completely the opposite?
Give me one example of how Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama have voted in ways that are unconstitutional. I would submit to you that George Bush, waging a war without the consent of Congress, without a declaration of war from Congress, which the Constitution clearly calls for, is unconstitutional. So, you know, match me and call me.
I didn't say voting against the Constitution. I said, what I'm talking about is whenever a person like McCain Feingold, I don't like McCain, don't get me wrong. I think he's a piece of crap like the other two, and then both of them ain't worth a powder and lead to blow them to hell with. But what I'm saying is whenever they start attacking the First Amendment, the Second Amendment especially, these people, and they did vote to send our troops into Iraq. There wasn't a declaration of war, but by constitutional rights, they do have the right to do that. The commander-in-chief has the right to send troops. And all he done was say, Congress, do you want to do this? They said, yes. He sent them in. After 11 or 12 or 13 years of complete...
Hang on just a second here, Jonathan. That, you know, the UN had inspectors in Iraq, and the resolution that Hillary Clinton voted for and Barack Obama did not vote for, but that Hillary Clinton and John McCain voted for, you're absolutely right. He did not have an opportunity to make that decision, although he was speaking out against it. But nonetheless, that resolution that they both signed, that they both voted for, said that Bush had to certify before Congress that all options had been exhausted and that there was a clear connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11.
No, you're wrong.
Can go to whitehouse.gov and you can find the letter that George Bush wrote to Congress about a month after the invasion in compliance with that resolution, stating that there was a connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11.
Okay, after, a month after.
And it was a lie.
Explain to me, how does that work a month after the troops are already on ground?
Because that's what the resolution said. The resolution said that if you go in, you have to justify it to us after the fact. And he did. And it was a lie.
I've already read you're wrong on that. I've not seen that, but I'm going to look it up. But what I've seen is it's...
Find it over on the White House website.
But what I'm saying is, you're saying you love the Constitution, but you'd vote for Obama or Hillary. That right there is a complete contradiction.
I suspect that the only part of the Constitution that you're familiar with is the Second Amendment. Is that really what we're talking about here?
Okay, see, no, you're wrong. I'm also with the First Amendment, which is the power of the press, the freedom of religion, the freedom of the press, the freedom of files.
Why don't you join with James Madison, whose first veto, the fourth president of the United States, whose first veto was to veto a faith-based initiative. He vetoed a bill by Congress that gave money to a church to feed poor people and house poor people, saying that this government should never give money to religion because then it's going to start getting in bed with religion and that's going to be a bad thing
for religion. Should never. Should never do that because that is a separation. That is separation.
That's great. You know, we're finding some common ground. What are you objecting to then? I don't get it.
You're saying that you're voting for these people, want to get these people in, and both of them are Marxists. Completely against the Constitution.
Give me one example of how they're Marxists.
They'll rip the Constitution and make it out into toilet paper.
One example of how they're Marxists.
What do you mean? Look at how they voted against the First Amendment and the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment's the only thing.
Okay, Jonathan, I'm really sorry. We're just plain old flat out of time. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman. Program. Welcome to the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
It is April 15th, the day when, we've got to pay our taxes, or at least file our extensions. And also the day when all the folks who think that the idea that taxes are the cost of admission to a civil society is just a silly notion, and maybe we should just fund the whole thing on debt. Grover Norquist is with us. We recently talked to them about his new book, Leave Us Alone, Getting the Government's Hands Off Our Money, Our Guns, and Our Lives. Americans for Tax Reform, his website, his organization, ATR.org, the website. Grover Norquist, welcome.
Glad to be with you.
Thank you. Tell me, what? I don't get the logic of this. We are running up a $9 trillion debt, and you say we should cut taxes.
Well, there are two things. First of all is we need to reduce spending. The government is spending too much money. The cost of government is not the deficit. The cost of government is how much money the government spends. Looking at the deficit is like looking at the top of the iceberg. It's a piece of the iceberg, but the Titanic went down not because it hit the nice white part that stuck up above the water, but the very big and nine times larger deadly part underneath.
And I would submit to you that that's the deficit, and the deficit is the result of 28 years of Reaganomics. You know, Dick Cheney famously said just before the 2004 election, Reagan taught us that deficits don't matter. And here we have three presidents, Reagan and two Bushes, who collectively have run up 70% of the total debt of the United States, and Reagan himself ran up more debt than every president from George Washington till Reagan combined. And he did it by, you know, this bizarre tax policy that you guys are advocating of let's borrow from our grandchildren and children. We're going to pay $300 billion this year just on the interest on the money that Reagan and the first Bush borrowed. And somehow that passes for sane fiscal policy. I don't get it.
Well, you're focused on the tax side. It's the spending side that costs.
But today is tax day.
Right. And the Reagan administration, cut taxes, and the government had more revenue come in, more revenue in total, more revenue as a percentage of the economy.
More revenue also comes in when you raise taxes. The fact of the matter is that year after year, the economy grows. There's always going to be more revenue.
Well, actually, when the government has raised taxes, such as the capital gains taxes that Nixon so cleverly raised back in 69, revenue from capital gains collapsed.
For 1 year. For 1 year, because a lot of small businessmen and a lot of business people said, okay, I'm not going to sell this year because I'll have a capital gains tax, but it recovered. It recovered within a year or two.
No, it was in 78 when the Democrats cut the capital gains tax in half, you saw a jump in the amount of revenue that came in.
Sure, that would be the year that everybody would sell their long-term capital gains.
And it kept
And in fact, I did that year.
But the higher levels continued, as they did after 2003 with the tax. I mean, if you think higher taxes will raise permanently more money without slowing down economic growth, you have a hard time explaining Europe. I mean, the European countries with high marginal tax rates have double the unemployment rate that the United States does and have had slower growth.
Those depends on how you define unemployment. And you know that as well as I do.
The Europeans fudged their unemployment, put a whole bunch of guys in college. Their unemployment, they say it's 10%. It's actually much higher because they've got so many people they've got squirreled away with.
In universities getting free educations. And we shouldn't do that, right? Because that would be government spending rather than investing.
How many years do you keep a guy in graduate school and pretend that he's at school?
Until somebody gets a degree and they're a productive member of society. We've got folks running around saying we need to bring in more people with H-1B visas because we're not producing enough scientists. And at the same time, we've got people like you saying, oh, but, you know, it's an expense to government if we were to have free college education. I beg to differ. It would be an investment.
Kind of here. This is the point that the Europeans talk to Europeans themselves. They'll tell you, their economists will tell you that they mask their real unemployment rates because people stay in school past getting their degree.
Right, and we mask our real unemployment rates by saying, oh, those people living on the streets or those people living in the SROs, they've been unemployed more than a year and a half, so we're not going to count them anymore.
Well, anybody who's looking for work counts as unemployed in the country.
No, not true. There's a whole category of what are called discouraged workers, people who have been unemployed for more than, I think it's a year and a half, maybe it's 2 years, and they're no longer counted as unemployed.
If you're looking for work, you're counted. That's the government's rules. It wouldn't surprise me if the government doesn't follow their rules. I'm not the guy who's apologizing for how the government behaves, but that is the government's rules.
Okay, so back to this question of taxes.
The government spends too much money. A low rate of taxation gives you stronger economic growth, sadly gives the government more
money.
What
is the government spending too much money on?
Well, I would start with sugar subsidies, which raise the price of sugar from the world price to about two or three times the
world price.
Okay, so
that's going to account for what fraction of the federal budget?
Oh, it's very small. I would
go to... what, a thousandth of 1%?
Well, we can go to the larger numbers.
Give me something that's more than 10%.
How about the farm subsidies in toto make consumers less well off, and I would argue over time make farmers less well off. The countries that compete with us on farm subsidies do not have happier farmers.
And what percentage is that?
The federal, I don't know, it's $10 or $20 billion a year right now.
Right. So, again, we're talking about, you know, far less than a hundredth of 1%.
Okay. Well, I'd take
I'm not hearing anything that's even going to hit 1% reduction in the federal budget, and yet, you know, we're still continuing to run $900 billion a year deficits.
If the government didn't increase spending this year and just operated on the amount of money, that would be a significant drop in the total cost. You don't do these things overnight. You reduce the growth of spending that you have.
Why is it that during the Eisenhower administration, when you had a Republican president and a Republican Congress, actually, at the end of the Truman administration, and the top marginal tax rate was 91%, it kicked in after you made your $3.2 million in today's dollars, that we didn't have, yes, the government wasn't always operating within a balanced budget, but we weren't seeing these massive additions to the deficit like we saw under Reagan, Bush, and Bush. And the country became the largest industrial powerhouse in the world.
Well, first of all, back then that was pre-Medicare, Medicaid, or an indexed Social Security system, all of which generate tremendous growth in spending, and the largest growth in spending are all from those entitlements. So you're asking, if you go pre
we had Social Security during the Eisenhower administration, and none of those things are paid for out of income taxes anyway. They're paid out of FICA.
Well, that doesn't have anything to do with whether it affects the deficit or total government spending. You can call it a tax on income something different if you want to, but it's still spending. It still costs the economy money. Back to the spending questions, how about the Davis-Bacon Act, which was put in to keep black people out of work in the 1930s and still continues to be something to keep low-income people out of work from. It's a law that says if the federal government funds something like a highway or a building, that you have to pay
the prevailing
unionized wages, which
no,
is
you have to pay the prevailing wage. No, it's not necessarily the unionized wage.
You can't put it to bid and get the best price. You have to pay what are the unionized wages, which raises the cost 30% from what it would otherwise.
To the extent that that might have been put into place to keep black people out of the workplace, which is, I realize, the conservative
view. They advertised it that way.
And you guys were saying the same thing was true about unionization at the time.
Well, there was some of the unionization was put forward under that on that category.
Yeah, but the
old slogan
certainly.
From the South African Communist Party: "Workers unite for a white South Africa." People have
but,
long.
But
used,
the point is that that's not how it's used today.
Oh, yes, it is. I talked to a congressman and said, "You want to raise taxes?" And he says, "Yeah, I want to raise taxes so we can build more bridges and stuff, and that's important." I said, "Get rid of the Davis-Bacon Act. You could have 25% more bridges and more safe bridges and more highways." And he said, you want everything in this country built by Hispanics? It remains a racist law. You asked for how to save money. I give you a way to get rid of stupid racist laws and save money, and you want to argue
doing
with
away
me.
No, my
you
point is doing away with doing
Let's
away
get rid of
no
racism
I don't I would like to
spending.
Cut military spending. Here you have almost half of our discretionary budget, you know, $500 billion a year. Why do we have to be
the
world's
federal budget, right?
Say that again.
20% of the federal budget,
right?
Defense.
Right, and I was asking you for something that was even 1% that you would cut, and you couldn't come up with something. I'm giving you 20% of the total federal budget, and I'm saying cut it by a third. We don't need to be the world's police.
Well, if you weren't in Iraq, it'd save maybe 1% of GDP, right?
Right, but we've got bases in what, 170, 190 bases around the world?
Okay, well,
isn't there something crazy about
Americans,
that?
No, Americans for Tax Reform has long been supporters of the base closings legislation, the legislation that where people would put together a list of bases and say, we're going to close these down because the Pentagon doesn't even want them anymore. They weren't closing any bases the Pentagon said they wanted, said the bases the Pentagon says they didn't need, and then as long as the Congress didn't override that and vote it down, it would take place.
Well, I think maybe Grover Norquist, you and I have found a point where we agree, and that is that the Pentagon has been a pork barrel project for both parties for far too long.
That whole process was derailed when Clinton stepped in and undid a couple of the California bases that needed to be closed. He broke faith with people by not allowing the process to go forward, and then they closed the process down until Bush got in. We could have saved billions more dollars, and we have saved tens of billions of dollars by closing down bases because Clinton was playing politics with that. And
I don't disagree. But you're also talking about domestic bases, and I'm talking about international bases.
The most recent one they did included international
and
bases.
And Star Wars and all these Reagan spent $1 trillion on Star Wars, and it still isn't successful. I mean, we've spent trillions of dollars on this thing, and we've got a multi-trillion-dollar debt.
Okay. I don't think Reagan spent $1 trillion since that would have been his entire budget for 3 years.
Oh, right? You're right. You're right. I'm sorry.
He
spent
a lot
several hundred billion dollars.
A trillion is not.
Wasn't it like $100 billion a year for the last 3 or 4 years of his administration that he was
spending? Total spending was $300 billion going into the Clinton year on defense.
Okay. All right.
So it wasn't
a
third of defense.
Okay. All right.
But it was
substantial. Yeah.
On what they were doing. Look, we can reduce spending, but you know, when we try and work with our liberal friends on this, I remember when Barney Frank came to talk to some free market guys and says, well, if you guys would get rid of your farm subsidies, we'd be willing to do welfare reform. Well, we phased out farm subsidies when the Republicans took office. They came back in when the Democrats took the Senate again, unfortunately. But Barney Frank kept voting against the welfare reform.
But what's wrong with simply raising taxes to the point where it equals the cost of government right now? And then
because
the American people will look at that and say, hey, my taxes have just been raised. Maybe government costs too much. And they may align themselves with you, or they may say, hey, my taxes have been raised and, you know, big deal, or the taxes on the wealthy have been raised, or my taxes have been raised and now my employer is going to have to give me a raise to match that. I mean, the fact of the matter is in those countries like France or Sweden, where taxes are literally 50% of income, incomes are higher.
The amount of money that people have to actually spend on goods and services, those countries are poorer than the United States on average, not richer.
Then why do they have a better standard of living, happiness index,
don't have higher happier indexes, and they have a much worse standard of living than the United States does on average, unless you're talking the kings or something over there.
Measured by longevity, for example? We're 29th in the world behind virtually all of the Western European and Northern European countries.
I thought you were talking about how people's standard of living.
I'm talking about quality of life. If you're measuring standard of living by what? The size of somebody's house?
The size of their house. The amount of resources they have to decide what they want to do with.
Yeah, but so the amount of stuff they have. I don't think that that's...
Or whether people want to move there or not move there. Yeah. People move from there to here, not the other way around.
All right. Well, it's an interesting conversation.
We're not in France, for crying out loud. There's a reason. We could move to France if we wanted to.
Well, actually, it's a little more difficult than that. But, you know, your points are well made.
Whether they have French Tom Tancredo in France trying to keep us out or something?
They absolutely do, I'm telling you. And it's a huge big deal. And in fact, Berlusconi just got elected in part on that thing.
A quick project for you that honest liberals should be for. And this is the transparency issue. Ralph Nader and I sent a letter a year ago to your governor and all the other governors and said, why don't you put every contract the state lets on the web and every expenditure on the web? Seven states have now done this, okay? Yeah. Texas, every check the state of Texas writes goes right up on the web.
And the federal government should do it as well. Grover Norquist, I agree with you.
California, for crying out loud, should be cutting edge here.
There you go. Okay, Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform. It's tax day today, ATR.org. Thanks for coming by.
Take care.
Good talking with you. 20 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com, for the network's blogs and website, stick around. It's tax day. We'll be right back.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
To the limit and not heed the warnings, 'cause I'll be my old self when I wake in the morning. Oh, but the night's still young, so I'm gonna have fun.
25 minutes past the hour. Some of the news here today. We really need to take this stuff seriously. Headlines from today's Financial Times. Fear that Russian oil output has peaked. Russian oil production has peaked and may never return to current levels, fueling concerns that the world's biggest oil producers cannot keep up with rampant Asian demand. That's one. Here's another one. A headline. Wachovia warns on U.S. outlook after loss. Wachovia, the fourth largest U.S. bank by assets, warned yesterday that the nation's economy was deteriorating more rapidly than expected. This is from the front page of the Financial Times today. Holy cow. The economy is deteriorating. But, you know, hey, Bush says the fundamentals are fine. McCain says the fundamentals are fine. Bush says this is just a correction. McCain says this is just a correction. Bush says everything, you know, cut taxes some more. Everything will be great. McCain says cut taxes some more. Everything will be great. Yeah, we'll just let our grandchildren pay for it. I mean, give me a $9, $10, $12 trillion credit card. I'll show you what it looks like to live large. And it worked for Reagan. It worked for Bush Sr. Bill Clinton rolled that back somewhat. The only president in recent history to submit a balanced budget.
and in fact a surplus budget. And now George W. doing the same thing, taking us from a $5 trillion deficit to a $9 trillion deficit. When are we going to learn? Well, hopefully soon. 27 minutes past it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Well, let's see here. According to Grover Norquist's Americans for Tax Reform, they passed out this, you know, which April 15th would you rather have? And they say under McCain, the top tax rate would be 35%. Under Hillary and Obama, the tax rate for millionaires and billionaires would be 39.6%. That would be, in other words, rolling back the Bush tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. Yeah, sounds like a plan to me. Capital gains rate. That is, you know, if you make your money buying and selling stock or building up a company and selling it off, the capital gains rate, 15% under McCain, which is where it's at right now. Hillary and Obama, 20%. I remember when capital gains were the same as income tax rates, although I also remember in 1978 they got dropped a whole bunch because I sold a business that year and it factored into that decision. I don't think we should be tinkering with these things. I mean, I've seen it up front and personal. And yeah, you want to get a short-term boost in revenues? Cut your capital gains tax. And what you'll find is a whole bunch of small business people will sell out to large business people, and you'll lose another chunk of entrepreneurial America. And a whole bunch of people will sell stock. But you know, it's just a bump. It's just rearranging deck chairs. The dividends rate under McCain, 15%. In other words, if you make your living owning stock and sitting around on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive, under McCain, the maximum tax you pay will be 15%. Under Hillary and Obama, it would be 39.6%, which is the income tax rate. I think that's reasonable. Why should somebody who earns their living sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive pay any less income tax than somebody who is out digging ditches or doing a radio talk show or teaching in a school or being a fireman or a police officer? Why? I don't get it. Emery in Venice, California. Hey, Emery, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you doing, Tom?
I'm great.
That guy's off his rocker. I mean, he's Orwellian in his thinking, and he's quoting 20, 30-year-old polls about American lifestyle in order to substantiate current world views. I mean, does he really believe that, like, we're all going to be better off if we become greedy, selfish bastards?
Yeah, I think so. I really think that there is this strain of libertarianism, and Grover Norquist is probably more of a libertarian than he is a conservative. That you know, the libertarian philosophy, I refer to libertarians as Republicans who want to get laid and get high, right? They want to smoke dope and be able to patronize prostitutes, because basically their position is that the only role for government is defense. That's the only thing it should be doing. There should not be any kind of social safety net. Hey, if you weren't born rich, to hell with you. You know, if you don't have any bootstraps, go find some, you know, et cetera. And they think that, you know, victimless crimes, what they define as victimless crimes like prostitution and the sale of drugs, should not be illegal. And because they are in favor of decriminalizing victimless crimes, somehow people think that libertarians are liberals. I'm sorry, they're not. They are Republicans who want to get high and get laid. And
it sounds like that, you know, I mean, I know that the conservatives tend to want to have their 91% believing in God. It sounds like a hedonistic branch of puritanicals.
Yeah, I'm not sure it has to do with religion. I mean, they'll exploit religion, you know, certainly, and constantly have. And you know, I don't think this has to do. But you know, Emery, thanks for the call, and you know, interesting point. Bill in Seattle. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Tom. I'm glad Grover Norquist feels pretty relieved that, and happy that Star Wars only cost $300 billion.
I'm
a little upset to be reminded of that fact.
Yeah, I needed to go back and check my numbers, but I strongly recall that we've spent over $1 trillion on Star Wars. Now, it might be from the day that Reagan started it until now. I thought it was through the 8 years of the Reagan presidency. I'm going to have to go back and fact check that. His point was that the federal budget for defense was only $300 billion a year. But you multiply that over 8 years, and there was a lot of money to pull out of there for Star Wars.
Just incredible amount of money that was spent on that for just down a hole, really.
And still is being spent on it.
Yeah.
Still is being spent on it. I mean, this recent thing where they shot a satellite out of the sky was supposed to be, you know, hey, yeah, we finally got this thing working, sort of, maybe.
It was lit up by a target, right?
Right.
It was lit up by a laser.
Right.
Unbelievable. Hey, yeah. Tom, really, something that really bothers me is, when Reagan came in, I was both a small businessman and a union carpenter. And, you know, Reagan gets a pass for cutting taxes, especially in being a friend of the small businessman. And he was a friend of neither the worker nor the small businessman.
Yeah.
Carter's FICA tax, and prior to Reagan, there was a tax break for self-employed. The total FICA tax was 7.8. For self-employed for,
right.
For
Reagan doubled it.
9.6. Reagan raised both rates to 15.3.
Yeah, I remember because I owned a small business at that time too. And you're spot on, Bill. Absolutely right. And people just don't remember the Reagan legacy. Joe in Paris, France. You want to? Assuming you're listening on the website, and thank you for listening there in Paris, France. What's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you, Joe?
Yeah, as always. I'm calling. I'm always amused by the conservatives and what they have to say about living abroad, especially Grover Norquist's attempt to contradict you when you mentioned that some people consider that the quality of life is perhaps a little bit better over here in a lot of ways than it is back there, in that the people move from Europe to the United States and not the other way around, which, of course, is sort of a fallacy. But I called up to say that I just happened to do my own taxes today, my French taxes, and looking at the figures as I do every year and saying, wow, that's a lot. It's perhaps considerably more than I would be paying if I were living in the States right now. But, you know, I walk out of the door after finishing that up, and, I walk through streets that are, relatively clean and safe, and I can get around in Paris here on the metro with very little problem, and a large chunk of those taxes go into a healthcare system that works pretty well, and I have to say that for most of us who've been here, the expatriate community, the people who've been here, say 10 years or longer, in most cases, in almost all cases, we would have to be nuts to want to go back.
Hmm. And I'm assuming that the process of emigration I have relatives in Norway. And it's damn near impossible to get Norway to let you to emigrate.
Well, Canada is more difficult than it is here, I think, for Americans in a lot of ways. It took me a good 5 years and I've been here for in excess of 20, in order to have the long-term residence card and the permit. I mean, it's much more difficult to do it in reverse going to the United States. But, when you look at the objective measures and people move for all sorts of reasons, subjective reasons, that have nothing to do with the financial bottom line, but there's certain advantages that we have over here. I would have to say that in a very generalized bottom line sense of the quality of life, we're pretty well taken care of here. It's a nice place to work. It's a good place to retire, and no real need to change your nationality. You can remain. You can remain an American citizen in your contact with the U.S., but part of the problem with this question of moving is that Europeans do have a sense of, I don't mean to say that they have much more of a sense of adventure than Americans do, or visualizing the possibility of living abroad, but it doesn't occur to very many Americans to do that, and this has a lot to do with why somebody would move to one place or another, and decide to set up a permanent residence.
Now, the position that I've taken on taxes over the years, Joe, and you tell me, I mean, you live in Paris and the taxes and you're paying taxes to France, income taxes to France. The position I've taken is that if let's say that somebody's being paid just to pull a number out of the air, let's say they're being paid $50,000 a year, and they're paying here in the United States, and they're paying a 30% tax rate on that, and or let's say they're making $100,000 a year, and they're paying a 30% tax rate on that, and so they're actually taking home $70,000 a year. That means that they're, and I'm just using this because it's easy with round numbers, that means that their employer knows that they're willing to work for $70,000 a year. So
exactly.
if the tax rate were to drop, if Grover Norquist had his way, and instead of paying 30%, they were paying 10%, which would give them, you know, $90,000 a year, I submit to you that the employers would say to themselves, hey, we already know this guy will work for $70,000 a year. We're going to cut his pay by $20,000 a year, because at the end of the day, we know that he'll work for a take-home pay of $70,000 a year. On the other hand, if we were to institute a full national health care system and free college education for everybody like you have in France, and his tax rates went from 30% up to, say, 40%, so now instead of his take home being $70,000, $60,000, at that point he'd say, you know, I'm not sure I want to work for $60,000. His employer would have to pay him $110,000, and so he's ending up with his $70,000 take home pay at the end of the day anyway. That regardless of the tax rate, it's the take home pay that matters. Am I right?
Yeah, well, it's sure. I mean, that's, you know, the conservatives like to talk about the market. That's the market.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's the marketplace for labor.
You know, they tend to look away from those simple realities. And it's true here. It's the tax rate is considerably higher. And I would say that you could probably, for somebody making the equivalent there, you're probably talking about upwards of 50% when you're talking, toward 50%.
Right, but in compensation, the salaries are higher, right?
Well, salaries are much higher for, and even with that, the number of working hours is less. There's,
right.
Considerable.
There you go.
Considerably more.
And you get all those 5 or 6 weeks a year in vacation. Joe, I'm sorry, we got to take a break. We're out of time, but thank you so much for listening to us in Paris, France, and for calling in.
And thank you, Tom. We'll talk again.
Okay, great. Much appreciated. 45 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270. TomHartmann.com for our live chat room. AirAmerica.com for their blogs.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
Play something country. Now play something country.
At the top of the next hour, we're going to have Scott Horton on. He has this absolutely mind-boggling article in the current issue of Harper's about a guy at Guantanamo, a U.S. military lawyer, who stood up and said no. And what happened to him? I've got to share this story with you. And so we'll be talking with Tim at the top of the next hour. We'll be picking up your calls at quarter after, at about 25 minutes from now. Right now, Ellen Ratner with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen. What's up?
Well, quite a few things. Washington is getting ready for the Pope's visit, and the President is going to be visiting him this afternoon. He's actually the first head of state that he is greeting at Andrews Air Force Base as the plane comes in.
Mm-hmm.
On some other fronts, Senator McCain today was at University of Pittsburgh. As you know, there is actually a primary there as well. And he was trying to come off as a populist. He took real pointed remarks at banks, CEOs, and major corporations. He said that they are to blame for a lot of the economic problems, saying that the people we expect to be most sober and level-headed in their economic decisions, bankers and other homelenders, forgot some of the basic standards of their own profession. He has several proposals which he outlined today. One was to require couples making more than $160,000, you and I talked about that this morning on your other show, who are enrolled in Medicare to pay more for prescription drug coverage. Two, to freeze non-defense discretionary spending for a year. To raise the tax exemption for each child from $3,500 to $7,000. Suspend the federal gas tax this summer between Memorial and Labor Day. A very popular plan. Lower the corporate income tax rate from 35 to 25%. Allow taxpayers to file under a less complicated system with two tax rates and a standard deduction, so flatter income tax. And make the Department of Education work with state governors to make sure that the state's guarantee agency, which backs students' loans, is able to take be the lender of last resorts to students. He's sounding, on some of these, a little Democratic, actually.
So John McCain wants to means test Medicaid, or Medicare, rather, which will turn it into a
just
welfare
for the prescription
program.
Drug coverage.
Right, but this is the...
Yes, that's means testing, you're right.
Yeah, this is the camel's nose under the edge of the tent. Turn these things into welfare programs, and then, you know, welfare programs go away. And so instead of it being an entitlement, it'll become a welfare program, basically. He wants to reduce taxes, cut corporate taxes, suspend the gas tax. How are we supposed to pay for repairing our roads that are falling apart and our bridges? And if he's going to, you know, cut income taxes and particularly corporate taxes, I mean, we're down as...
Well, he's certainly not going to take away from the military, is he?
No, he's not. And he wants to level out non-military discretionary spending, which means basically cut all government programs by the rate of inflation, which right now, depending on how you calculate it, is somewhere between 3% and 10%.
I just got to tell you that I don't disagree with that. Let me go on to some other things.
Alrighty.
I agree with you 100% on it. The two things this afternoon, Jay Tamboli, our good attorney reporter, is actually going to be at a hearing that the ACLU is testifying on those national security letters. So that should be extremely interesting.
Now,
also, for
our listeners who don't know, the national security letters are where the FBI basically, instead of getting a warrant, they just write a letter saying, you know, we want to snoop on this person, and there's some concern that this has been considerably abused.
Exactly. Yeah. Also, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates was Secretary Condoleezza Rice. They're talking about this whole idea of non-military instruments of national power. What that really means is that what he's saying is that our military can't do everything, and what America must do is to help strategic partner nations build their own security forces before these problems face the United States. Well, that's a great idea, and of course that's what they're trying to do in places such as Liberia, in places such as southern Sudan, but sometimes the fantasy is not reality, and I'm not sure if people in the military are really taking a good look at that.
Yeah, and you and I, just having recently returned from southern Sudan, I mean, something needs to be done.
Exactly. And we can't just say to a military, foreign military, take it over. It's not going to happen. You and I know that. Also, they're going to tighten rules. They are trying to. There's another hearing this afternoon about tightening rules on overseas contractors, and this would require overseas and commercial government contractors to report fraud or overbilling. They want to attach more to that in terms of contracts and bills. So that is going to be very interesting. And also, Speaker Pelosi this morning had a talk, and she says that longer deployments are resulting in a lot more PTSD cases, and she calls it the President's War. She said the President's War, now in its sixth year, is taking a grave toll on our troops as deployments continue and our forces and their families grow more stressed. And she said that almost 59,000 veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan have been diagnosed by PTSD by the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Yeah, this is longer than World War II. I mean, this is
exactly
terrible, terrible occupation. We have about a minute here, Ellen.
Okay.
Any other news?
Well, I think the only other news that we're sort of getting big time is the news that is coming out of the campaigns and that...
Oh, that, let me ask you. Barack Obama, at the top of Huffington Post, this a blogger in Pennsylvania, I don't have my paper in front of me, interviewed... Barack Obama, and Obama said that he would immediately, as soon as he became president, he would speak with his Justice Department and Attorney General to immediately review information that's out there to determine whether there have been crimes or the possibility of crimes committed by the Bush administration and pursue prosecutions if that's the case.
Yeah, that's not going to make him very popular with a fair amount of the war segment, but I got news for you. I talked to my brother Michael Ratner last night, and we talked about the Bush story that he approved torture. My brother said he's not going to necessarily be welcome in a lot of European capitals.
Yeah, well, if an Obama administration was going to look into this, man, I mean, that would be an amazing... I'd like to hear Hillary Clinton say the same thing.
I would, too.
Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Well, there are some aspects to this presidential campaign and stories in general. Welcome back to our program, by the way, the third hour of our show. That the corporate media in the United States just doesn't seem to have any interest in covering whatsoever. For example, a couple of nights ago in the Faith Forum, after Hillary Clinton had said that an elitist image was what caused Al Gore to lose the 2000 election. Al Gore, who got 5 million more votes than George W. Bush in that election. And we learned a year later, and when the vote was finally counted from Florida, he actually won Florida. Barack Obama came forward and he said, by the way, I think Al Gore won. Talk about an inconvenient truth. It was not even covered by the media. It was totally, you know, just long. And yesterday, Barack Obama talking at Philly.com, talking with a blogger, said, yeah, I want to find out directly from my attorney general, are there possibilities of genuine crimes as opposed to bad policies in the Bush administration? Have war crimes been committed? Well, in fact, apparently some of the lawyers who have worked for the Bush administration think so. Scott Horton has written an absolutely brilliant piece for Harper's Magazine, and you can find it over the archives of Harper's, harper's.org, or go out and buy it. It's in the April 8th issue, Harper's Magazine. It's called A Tale of Three Lawyers. And Scott's in Brussels, Belgium at the moment, but was kind enough to come on the line with us. Hey, Scott.
Hey, great to be with you, Tom.
Thank you. And how is Europe today?
Well, I tell you, they got great food here. No doubt about that.
Yeah. And our dollar is worth just about nothing.
Yeah, it's very expensive. Everything is.
Okay, let's talk about Lieutenant Commander Matthew Diaz.
A hero, I think. A real hero.
And is it Diaz or Diaz? Or how
Diaz, yeah.
Diaz, okay. A genuine hero. This is a guy who was a staff judge advocate at Guantanamo. He was in the military, and he was an attorney. And as a uniformed officer, you point out, he had to uphold, he had to do what he was told, but he was also an attorney and had to uphold the law. And therein came the collision.
That's exactly right. It, you know, came down to an issue about the secrecy of the detainees at Guantanamo. Now, that's something that's been overcome. But, you know, Donald Rumsfeld, when he set up the facility there, decided he wanted to keep the identity of the people who were held there a secret. And, of course, international law and United States law requires that their identity be known.
Right, at the very least to the International Red Cross.
Exactly. So it doesn't have to be published, but the Red Cross has to be informed who they are, and the Red Cross has a right to inform their relatives and loved ones that they are being held in a prison somewhere.
Right.
And
the Supreme Court has ruled twice on this, essentially upholding these principles.
That's exactly right, and the Supreme Court had ruled in its second opinion, making it quite clear that this obligation of giving up the names was there and it was binding, and in fact it's a crime not to have done this. And Diaz decided that he would give up the names to some of the attorneys who had been seeking them in the litigation. And, you know, he subsequently says, look, this was a mistake. I shouldn't have done it, perhaps. But, you know, in fact, I was moved by the legality of the situation, the fact that this is something that should have been done and wasn't done, and I was myself a part of an operation that was being maintained illegally.
Right. This is a guy who said no when he was asked to commit a crime. And, in fact, you point out in the article that Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, under the second, the Hamdan case, the second Supreme Court decision, they said that the Geneva Conventions was binding upon the U.S. military and that a violation would constitute a criminal act. And in fact, you know, one senior member of the Bush legal team informed of the decision over lunch was reported to have turned white as a sheet and have immediately excused himself. For the following months, Bush administration lawyers entered into a frenzied discussion about how to protect themselves from criminal prosecution.
That's exactly right. And so I think that sets up this juxtaposition between Lieutenant Commander Diaz, who basically is acting to set things right and do things legally and correctly, and a group of lawyers working within the Bush administration at a very high level, who were the authors of a whole series of policies that were, you know, violations of the criminal law.
Right. And those and these lawyers principally being William J. Haynes II, who was the lawyer for Rumsfeld. He was Rumsfeld's general counsel. And John Yoo, who was working for Alberto Gonzalez, as I recall.
Exactly right. And yeah. And William J. Haynes II is now corporate general counsel to Chevron in San Mateo, California, where I'm sure he's taking down a massive six-figure salary. And John Yoo is a tenured professor at Bolt Hall at the University of California at Berkeley.
So neither of these guys, in ordering crimes be committed or in writing the legal rationalization for crimes to be committed by the Bush administration, what was defined as crimes both by international law and by our Supreme Court, neither of these guys have suffered any consequence or punishment. In fact, if anything, they have been widely rewarded. I mean, Yoo is out there; he's a media star, and as you
published
as you pointed
two
out,
books.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, Haynes is doing the circuit. So, what happened to Diaz, the guy who actually decided to uphold the Supreme Court decision and comply with the law and provide a copy of the names to a civil rights lawyer who had requested them in a federal court proceeding?
He was court-martialed, convicted, and sent 6 months in a brig. Then he was kicked out, stripped of his military rank, pension benefits, and you know, left the prison as a bankrupt. And now, beyond all of that, the Pentagon is working feverishly trying to strip him of his law license. They've gone to the jurisdiction where he was admitted to the bar, and they've said, you should disbar this person. He's disloyal.
So that's incredible. I mean, so we're talking about retribution on steroids here. Anybody who tells the truth, anybody who does the right thing, anybody who complies with the law will be punished if they go up against the Bush administration.
Yeah, I mean, it's the juxtaposition that is astonishing. I mean, here you got a lawyer with a conscience, so they come down on the guy like a ton of bricks. And then we've got lawyers who are the facilitators of torture, which is a crime.
And has led to, as you point out, 108 deaths, several of whom have, the majority of which have been ruled homicides.
That's right. And I'd say, you know, certainly several dozen of them linked directly to torture practices that were introduced. So people died and people have suffered, you know, serious wounds as a result of these policies being introduced. And these people aren't suffering at all now. And I think this reflects the policies of the Bush administration, which are to shield those within the administration who implemented the torture policies and to harass and harm those who complain about it.
Is there any sort of an organized effort to support Lieutenant Commander Diaz, who now is being, you know, essentially hounded into unemployment and poverty?
Yeah, well, in fact, he received the Reidenauer Prize as a truth teller, and the Nation Institute is taking communications and messages of support for him, and he's received many hundreds of them, in fact. And, you know, right now he's moving to New York, and he's trying to set up a new life.
It's,
so I think, you know, certainly he would welcome hearing from your viewers.
Yeah, and how can people contact him?
They can contact the Nation Institute, Suzanne at the Nation Institute.
And that would be, that's what publishes Nation Magazine, right?
Exactly.
And isn't there a website with nationmagazine.org?
I'll put up an address on my blog so that they'll have an email address to which they can send communications.
Okay.
That's at harpers.org, no comment blog.
Okay, harpers.org, the no-comment blog, and Sean will track that down today, and she'll also cross-post it over at tomhartman.com for you know, so we'll post to your blog, and on your blog you'll post the information, the contact information for Mr. Diaz. I know that there is a movement in Berkeley to get John Yoo basically kicked out of the University of California, that there have been petitions circulating. I've been getting copies of them. Do you know of, you know, is that the limit of the attempts by people to say, hey, wait a minute, the guys who were the authors of these torture memos, William Haynes, now the big shot at Chevron, and John Yoo, the professor at Berkeley, to hold them responsible?
Well, Well, I think we've got some things that are just getting started right now. John Conyers, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, has announced hearings on the 6th of May, which are designed to probe into the conduct of the torture lawyers and take evidence, to record evidence about what was done, I think with the idea that some future administration may actually act on it. Of course, we know that there's an internal investigation at the Department of Justice that's being conducted by the Office of Professional Responsibility looking into John Yoo, too. But I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about this in the coming 2 weeks.
Good. Well, Scott Horton, you've done a marvelous job. It's brilliantly written, A Tale of Three Lawyers, in the current issue of Harper's Magazine, also over at harpers.org. Thanks so much for writing it, and thanks so much for coming on the program all the way from Brussels, Belgium.
Great to be with you. Take care.
Thank you, Scott. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
So if you get over to the Philly.com website, Will Bunch, his attitude blog, there's also a link to it from the very top of Huffington Post right now, and I'm guessing that probably more and more news sites are going to be pointing to it. He's talking about a conversation he had with Barack Obama in which he asked, he says, I mentioned the report in my question, and I said, I know you've talked about reconciliation moving on, but there's also the issue of justice, and a lot of people, certainly around the world and certainly within this country, feel that crimes were possibly committed regarding torture, rendition, and illegal wiretapping. I wanted to know whether his Justice Department, quote, would aggressively go after and investigate whether crimes have been committed, end quote. That's obviously by the Bush administration. Here is what Barack Obama said, word for word. What I would want to do is have my Justice Department and my Attorney General immediately review the information that's already there and to find out there are inquiries that need to be pursued. I can't prejudge that because we don't have access to all the material right now. I think that you are right. If crimes have been committed, they should be investigated. You're also right that I would not want my first term consumed by what was perceived on the part of Republicans as a partisan witch hunt, because I think we've got too many problems we've got to solve. So this is an area where I want to exercise judgment. I would want to find out directly from my attorney general, having pursued, having looked at what's out there right now, are there possibilities of genuine crimes as opposed to really bad policies? And I think it's important. One of the things we've got to figure out in our political culture generally is distinguishing between really dumb policies and policies that rise to the level of criminal activity. You know, I often get questions about impeachment at town hall meetings, and I've said that it is not something I think would be fruitful to pursue because I think that impeachment is something that should be reserved for exceptional circumstances. Now, if I found out that there were high officials who knowingly, consciously broke existing laws, engaged in cover-ups of those crimes with knowledge forefront, then I think a basic principle of our Constitution is nobody is above the law, and I think that's roughly how I would look at it. Yeah. 1-866-303-2270, our phone number. Charlie in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, listening on WINS. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Tom. That's a great interview. As far as I can see it, with Yoo's view of the Constitution, there's about 8 things that he says the president can unilaterally do that have never, ever been accepted before. He can violate treaties without Congress, make war, imprison anyone he designates an enemy combatant for as long as he wants without the person having access to counsel, torture anybody he says is a suspect, kidnap and torture them, extraordinary rendition, the military tribunals, the kangaroo courts with no procedural safeguards, and then the wireless wiretapping outside of FISA. And then the real topper is, should anybody ever be injured by this and seek remedy, like the guy from Germany, they can be blocked from litigating by the president invoking state secrets. And when you look at the guy that you just talked about, Diaz, and compare that to Private Darby, who revealed Abu Ghraib, or Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame, you see the vindictive recriminations this administration uses. So I think the lawlessness that we've been talking about is pretty patent.
Yeah, and not only is it patent and obvious, but it's also a genuine lawlessness. I mean, we're talking about truly criminal activity, stuff that is truly not just spitting on the graves of the founders of this country, not just shredding the Constitution, but rising even above the Constitution of the United States to the level of international high crimes and misdemeanors.
Well said, Tom. Thanks again.
Charlie, thanks a lot for the call. Paul in Turner's Fall, Massachusetts, listening to WHMP. Hey, Paul.
Hi, Tom. My question is, or point is, it might be a good question to ask the candidates what their position is on the role of dissent in democracy and whether dissent is or can be patriotic.
Yeah,
because I feel it gets right to the point of free speech zones and a lot of the other abuses that have happened to people's right to dissent over the past 7 years.
Excellent question, and it's going to be very interesting to see what questions are asked tomorrow night. We know, for example, that when these debates are sponsored by the so-called clean coal industry, that questions about coal don't get asked. It's like, oh, man. Chris in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. What's up?
Well, I had a really, really quick comment regarding something you mentioned about taxes quite a long time ago, so I don't know if I'm out of time here.
No, that's fine. We're wrapping up the day here, and anything we've talked about today is fair game. Talking about my conversation with Grover Norquist and the follow-up after that. We've got about a minute before the break, by the way. What's up?
Okay, I'll make it real quick. Now, I got two quick things. One, with regards to the taxes, since American companies already pay taxes before paying out dividends to the investors, shouldn't investors actually get that? In a way, a dividend tax credit. We have that up here as well, by the way.
And, dividend tax credit. No, I don't think so. Because I disagree. Because regardless of what the corporation had to do in order to generate a dividend, the dividend is income to the individual, and the individual played no role in the corporation generating that money, other than buying stock in it. In fact, they didn't, in most cases, even buy the stock from the corporation. They didn't fund the corporation. You go to the New York Stock Exchange and buy stock. You're not buying, if you buy stock in GE, you're not buying it from GE. You're buying it from some other individual who owns it. So, no, I don't think so, number one. And number two, corporations only pay 7.4% of all federal taxes in the United States, down from 32% in 1952. And so, the share is so low as to be almost insignificant. It is not double taxation to say that after a corporation pays taxes, then you have to pay income tax, any more than it is to say that it's double taxation that after you pay income taxes, you shouldn't then have to pay, for example, a sales tax or gasoline tax or a property tax. Thanks for the call, though. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Wake up, shaking up America.
Our government is a fight for.
America.
34 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. One last bit of news that probably won't make the mainstream corporate media that I wanted to share with you today, actually out of the Financial Times, the British equivalent of the Wall Street Journal. Now that the Wall Street Journal is owned by Rupert Murdoch, I wouldn't use the word equivalent. But in any case, the British business paper. The headline is Turks have to adapt to a new way of thinking. And basically the essence of the article is about how the leading political party right now is being sued by the attorney general of the country for wanting to bring religious discussion into politics. It's against the law in Turkey. And this is something that they have to maintain if they want to become members of the European Union. And they also have to maintain if they want to keep, radicals out of government. And it's creating a bit of a dust-up. But in all probability, Mr. Babakan said the government fully supported, this is the Turkey's foreign minister, Ali Babakan, said the government fully supported the separation of the state and religion. So it seems that the governing party is coming around. Liz in Valley Glen, California. Hey, Liz, listen to K-Talk. What's up?
Hi, good morning. I loved your show this morning. It's an excellent show.
Thank you.
I just want to make I have a question for you, but I also have a comment that I wanted to make. You had said something about George Bush and why he does the things he does, and I have a theory. I call it the OIC theory. Other than his obvious issues with his daddy because daddy likes Jeb better. And he almost made his daddy cry on national television on some it was some magazine show a couple of years ago. He practically cried after the election, the Florida election. That was, you know. Anyway, I call it the OIC, the overly indulged child syndrome, where he's spoiled and willful, and he wants what he wants when he wants it, and I blame Barbara for it. I was in social services for many years. And I don't believe in child abuse, but every once in a while, a child needs a good thunk. Not abusive or anything, but just to get his attention.
Well, children need limits. I think that it's actually, I agree that there's a psychopathology of some sort there, and it probably tracks back to the family, and I would encourage you to check out Justin Frank's book, Bush on the Couch. It's He's a psychiatrist and professor of psychiatry, I believe, at George Washington University. His name is Justin Frank, and he wrote a book called Bush on the Couch, in which he, you know, somebody who is that public a figure, you can get better information about them than you can if they're sitting across the desk from you. Because when people are sitting across the desk from you, more often than not, they're telling you what they want you to think about them and what they think you want to hear than what's really going on. And it's a really startling analysis. Liz, got to move along, but thank you for the call. Joe in Tempe, Arizona, you want to disagree with me on these issues?
Hey, I'm a Republican. I listen to you. You have the answer for everything. Why don't you just run for president and solve every problem the country has?
Because I'd make a lousy politician. I'm a good talk show host. I'd make a lousy politician.
Well, you're not that good at talk show host because they pulled your plug in New York City. You know, you liberals, you really make me wonder. No wonder Randy left your Air America.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Joe. Ed in Hillsboro, Oregon. Hey, Ed.
Hey, how's it going, Tom? What do you say about Joe? Joe from France was great, and just as an aside, I think you really ought to talk to more expats on a more regular basis, just because I think we're a pretty sheltered society from what the rest of the world, you know, is going on, and that insight as to the quality of life in France, is something that, you know, a lot of people need to hear. But the reason I was calling is, going back to the beginning of the story, beginning of the show, all of the hysterical right-wingers, bloggers, and I think it was Jonathan that called in. You know, these folks are unhinged by their own fear. And, you know, I think that along with investigations, which definitely need to happen, that we need to have a discussion about the role of fear in our own politics. Yeah. And that, you know, whoever is president needs to use the bully pulpit of the office to discuss how fear has been misused in our domestic politics here.
It really has. And going back to Tom Ridge, what blew my mind was that it was only being discussed on the late night talk shows. He was talking with, as I recall, David Letterman. And, you know, this was after he left office as head of Homeland Security. And he was talking about the 2004 election, and he said, you know, the White House kept telling me to raise the terror alert when I didn't think it had to be raised, and they didn't give me reasons. And it was always, you know, when the news cycle was going against George Bush or for John Kerry, then all of a sudden the terror alerts would come out. And Ridge basically confessed to this on national television. It never got followed up. There was never an investigation. There was, you know, obviously it would be the Justice Department that should have to look into it. Yeah, like Gonzo's going to do that. No, spot on, Ed. And there needs to be a whole lot more focus on that. Jack in Los Angeles. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Well, the thing is that the Republican Party and so-called conservatives, they're really the chaos party. All they do is create chaos, destroy the government so they could privatize it, destroy the infrastructure. Whatever helps a person, they vote against anything that's helpful and vote for something that's destructive. You know, the tax balance is off balance because they gave all the tax breaks to people that make $1 million or more a year and raised the taxes on the people in the middle class. A guy that makes $1 million is in the same tax bracket that I'm in. And I think that's kind of obscene. And these conservatives that thinks that's fair, I mean, they're not paying for their fair share of the infrastructure.
Right, exactly. And part of that infrastructure is the stuff that goes along with that, with both the accumulation and the ownership of that wealth. It's everything from our banking system to our court system, you know, right across the board. Yeah, well said. Robin in San Rafael. Hey, Robin.
Hey, Tom, I love your show. I just wanted to correct something you said about the compassion thing that was on CNN the other day. Hillary said we had two very good men of faith run for president in 2000, 2004, but large segments of the electorate concluded that they did not really understand or relate to or, frankly, respect their ways of life. And the fact is Gore did win. The election was stolen, but he didn't win enough electoral votes. He lost Ohio. He lost his own state of Tennessee. He lost Indiana. He lost Kentucky. And I think her point is that I think the people on the coast, I'm in California, I think a lot of us are tone deaf to what's going on in the middle of the country.
Yeah, Robin, the fact of the matter is that he won 5 million more votes, popular votes, than George W. Bush did.
But he didn't
and when
win
you
enough.
Actually count the votes in Florida, you discover that he won the electoral vote as well.
But he wouldn't have needed Florida if he had won his own state of Tennessee.
Oh, yeah, I don't disagree, but I don't think that that's because he was tone deaf. I think he got lousy advice from Bob Shrum and some of the other advisors, and I think, frankly, he should have taken Bill Clinton's support. He should have, you know, he put some distance between himself and Clinton.
But I agree with you.
But to say that, you know, it wasn't... To say that the majority of Americans thought that he was some kind of an elitist when the majority of Americans voted for him.
No, she said large segments of the electorate concluded.
Well,
so I'm
okay.
Just correcting what you said based on the transcript, because Obama did say, well, Gore won. Well, she never said Gore didn't win.
Yeah.
And I have to correct one other thing from Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times and from the University of Chicago. Obama was never a professor of law. He lectured there. From 92 to 96, he never held the title of professor of law.
Okay, thank you, Robin, for that correction. He taught, yeah, he taught law. You're right. Gary, and being a professor is a whole big deal and a whole separate thing. And if I've used that word, I stand corrected. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTT. Hey, Gary.
Tom.
Yeah.
Tom Hartman, a man of great integrity. I'm saying it because I did hear that little reference from somebody that called in, and I'm just going to say it. Just flatly say it was below the belt and it was no class.
Oh, you know, you're talking about the guy who said, you know, Randy Rhodes is still a liberal as far as I know. God bless her. I mean, you know, he was just, I don't know, it was pretty pathetic.
He's frustrated because we're more on sides with the truth, what's going on in our country.
Yeah,
I think that's the bottom line. But anyway, what I called about just very... Shirley, I believe strongly for a long time, just as you do, that greed, and greed also is mental. Everybody thinks greed with money per se. Greed is also mental. How you treat your fellow workers, how you treat your friends, how you treat co-workers, and all the rest. This is what's motivating this behavior we have in our country.
Yeah, well said, Gary. Thank you very much, David in Santa Cruz. Got about a half a minute before the break here, David.
Okay, two quick points. I wanted to challenge Grover Norquist's assertions about expendable income.
Yeah.
I lived in Spain, and I saw firsthand that people basically had more money to spend because they weren't straddled with so much education and healthcare debt all the time.
Yeah.
And also wanted to say that Grover Norquist, I think, has a skewed vision of happiness, which is just the accumulation of things and wealth.
Yeah, and that's something that we all need to be pushing back on, because, you know, the happiness index, CNN did a great thing, you know, a great piece on this, or not CNN, excuse me, 60 Minutes, back about 3 months ago. Denmark is the happiest country in the world. And the taxes, you know, the tax rate is over 50% for, you know, for the average person. But, you know, they have free public education. They have they have a very, very good transportation infrastructure. They have a free public health system, a national healthcare system, single-payer healthcare system. It works. It's a country that works. And, in fact, we're going to be doing our show from there sometime this summer. I want to contrast. We were in Darfur and Sudan a couple of weeks ago, the worst in the world. We're going to go to Denmark, the best, and show the difference.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
Sing a song of taxes. Working class cancer sore. Tea in Boston Harbor. And Revolutionary War. Of giving to the rich. And taken from the poor. Sing a song of taxes. Let's even up the score. Sing a song of taxes in the presidential pew. throw in grease, senator.
Yeah, McCain out there running around going, yeah, no, we don't need no stinking taxes. We can run this government on debt. We can just let our children and grandchildren pay for it, or we can just ruin our currency. I mean, you're seeing that those chickens come home to roost. That's how, you know, we tried to run, we ran the Vietnam War on debt, and it came home to haunt us in the 70s, and now we're running this war on debt, and it's coming home to haunt us now. Anyhow, Mike in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi. When I hear a discussion of health care and education and then taxes, like in France, I just would like to people to think that in this country we have privatized taxes and for public good items such as health care and education and even toll roads. Any kind of health care premiums we pay, any type of student loans we repay are privatized taxes, and in this country, again, we're backwards to other countries, perhaps, or at least proper countries. We pay wars that are mainly health, the privilege, through public taxes rather than privatized taxes. I don't quite understand how things have gotten so messed up here.
Well, it's the theft of the commons, Mike. That's the bottom line. These are all the areas that you defined are areas that other countries consider the commons, and here in the United States we don't. In fact, we're moving in the opposite direction. We're selling off our commons. And, you know, I'll rant about that more some other time. Right now, Congressman Tim Bishop is on the line, the Democrat from New York. And Congressman Bishop, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
There is this piece of legislation that's going to be voted on presumably this week or next, the Beaches Environmental Assessment and Coastal Health Act, the Beach Act. And this is something that is, you're the co-author of this.
I am.
And it seems like a really decent piece of legislation. I just wanted to give my listeners a heads up on it.
All right, thank you. It should be a no-brainer, actually. I mean, this it authorizes up to $40 million for grant money to go to states, which they would then allocate to coastal communities so that those coastal communities can monitor the quality of their beaches. And it also requires that the EPA develop a new rapid testing procedure for bathing water so that they can, the determination can be made within 6 hours of whether or not that bathing water is safe to swim in.
So how do you respond to Grover Norquist type libertarians and conservatives who say, what? You're going to spend more government money? You know, this is something, if you want the beaches to be clean and the water to be pure, give them to a private corporation and they'll do it because there's a profit motive in it.
Well, yeah, that is the fundamental dichotomy, it seems to me, that we wrestle with down here all the time. And it seems to me that the dichotomy is that we Democrats think that government solves problems, and a great many Republicans think that government is the problem. And I think public health is clearly a governmental responsibility. And I think that if we think even for a second about privatizing that public health responsibility, we are on a path that is quite a perilous one.
This is a path that goes right back to Ronald Reagan.
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Tell that to the people in New Orleans, for example.
Tell that to the people at Bear Stearns.
well, we did.
at any rate, I would fundamentally disagree that the government does not have a role here. It clearly does.
And
it's a role that the government has played for a while. I think played it successfully, and it's one that we need to continue to maintain.
How do we revive, Congressman Bishop? How do we revive a discussion in the United States of the commons? I think that in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, even in the 1970s, any school child could tell you what the commons meant. You know, just the phrase, the commons. People understood that. It was taught in civics. It was taught in government classes. I don't think the majority of kids graduating from high school or college today, the majority of people who came of age since Reagan, even understand what the commons are.
Well, you know, I think that one of the things that I say to the audiences that I speak to all the time is that when, you know, most every event that I go to starts with the Pledge of Allegiance. And, you know, the part of the Pledge of Allegiance that I think is the most compelling is when we say one nation under God, indivisible. The indivisible part to me means that we're all in this together and that we all have a collective responsibility to one another and that we share in our collective fate. And I think we have lost that. And I think when the president talks about an ownership society, which he has talked about quite a bit, as you know, what he's really saying is you're on your own, guys, and I hope
right.
it works out for you.
Well, or those who own the most own society.
Yes. And I think that there is, an assessment of the common good that is missing. And there is also a willingness to sacrifice for the common good that is also missing. And I think we need a return to both, frankly.
Yeah, and this is the preamble to the Constitution. Out of the six major things that it identifies, only one has to do with defense. Create a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. I mean, five out of the six is the common. Well, arguably even the defense is the common.
Yeah.
So good on you, Congressman Tim Bishop. He is the co-author of the Beaches Environmental Assessment and Coastal Health Act. And let your congressman know, or woman know, that you support it. Congressman Bishop, thanks for being with us today.
All right, thanks for having me on.
Good talking with
Bye-bye.
You. Coming up tomorrow, Dr. Marlo Lewis from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. We're going to talk about global warming making us sick, and what do the world food crisis and war have to do with polygamy? Really? Really? And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there. Get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.